Session number 17476, Reel 3.
This is Burn Reel 3.
We were walking along the north side of the Acropolis, where there are, a few pine trees. And suddenly some bullets started whistling through the pine trees. There was a Greek artist there painting at his easel, and all three of us thought it'd be a good idea to sit down at that point. So we sat down, and then after a time, we crept round to the east end and somehow got back to the embassy. I don't remember that bit very clearly. And the streets were really rather empty. This was at about the time of the demonstration. I don't mean the exact time, but near it.
In how much danger did you feel yourself to be in?
What, under the bullets?
During the whole time of December?
Oh, the whole time of December. Oh, well, one felt one must just live day by day if one's alive at the end of it. I didn't somehow... It was so interesting, I didn't somehow feel very frightened.
Did you feel the communists were going to take over?
Field Marshal Alexander came, and he told our ambassador, the situation is grave. It is very grave. But I'll get you out of it. Only you must hang on. I can't do anything for a week, so you must hang on. And so one realized, I mean, we didn't hear this conversation, but it's in any of the books, Harold Macmillan's book, or biographies of Alexander. It was rather touch and go for the first week or 10 days. But of course, once Alexander had organized relief troops, we just gradually, but quite gradually, pushed them off, because a civil war is so different from an ordinary war with lines. And to make things more confusing, some of the communists had our uniform. And even spoke English. People whom we had been supporting, you see, they were the major part of the resistance in Greece.
Did you have any personal contact with any of the communists?
Not then, but after this, when we started inviting people to little parties, we got to know one of the communist ministers, Porfirio Yenis.
What do you remember about him and what he said?
I don't remember a great deal. He was a tallish man, quite good looking. And in fact, he had been with a legation party, so he must have been well known in our orbit for the evacuation, because at one time either Porfirio Yenis lost his trousers when the little embassy yacht was bombed off Milos, and so one of our diplomats gave him a pair of trousers. Or it was the other way round. Porfirio Yenis handed out a spare pair. It's just a little anecdote about him. And after a long time after the war, he suddenly sent us a postcard of the Tower of London. Quite amusing. I mean, I had nothing to do with him officially, of course.
with which group or faction, if any, did you and your husband have sympathy with at the time?
We had sympathy with Kanellopoulos, Panayotis Kanellopoulos, who was very much of a central figure and consequently got a bit pushed about when it came to jobs. But he was, after the war, he was Prime Minister for a very short reign. A delightful person and a scholar. We've got several of his books that he gave us. But he somehow, the middle way doesn't cut very much ice in Greece.
How had you come to know him?
I think it must have been through the embassy.
Did things start to improve whilst you were there?
Oh, once the siege was over. The siege. Now, the siege lasted from the 3rd of December until a truce on the 12th of January and the Varkiza agreement on the 12th or 14th of February. So it was quite a while, and during that time we had no running water, we had no electricity, we had no fuel for the fire. So we had to make do on wells and with army hurricane lamps for light. And at one time we had I ought to have said this previously, we were in the British School of Archaeology. That was the Second Embassy Mess, and that's in a garden, and one of the cypress trees was cut down to give us a little warmth in the evening in the common room there. But about the wells, there's this quite true story. The well in the British School compound was actually in the American School part. We shared a largish garden with the Americans, and they had the well. So when the communist rising took place, our Greek maids used to go up to draw water from the well. It so happened that we had soldier guards on the gateway. They saw these poor, underfed Greek women staggering off with the great terracotta water pot, bringing it back full. So the guards went up and carried it down for them. Well, there was a temporary director in the American part, and he sent a very strict note saying that he did not want to see soldiers drawing water from his well because it compromised his neutrality. As far as I can make out, we were the only source of food, so he would have been eating army rations brought up at the risk of a man's life, and it did not compromise his neutrality.
When about would that have been?
Oh, it would have been in December of 44.
How did your work then proceed after this?
Well, can I go on with the siege? Because there were one or two quite interesting points. In fact, all the good and great came later on. First, Harold Macmillan came, and he came over from Italy, and just to see what was going on. And he stayed for about a month, and he was the most marvelous person to have in siege, because he was so full of good cheer, and he was very witty and amusing. He used to come down into Chancery, where we were gathered together with our hurricane lamp, when we knocked off at about six and had drinks. And he entertained us like anything. Of course, at the smell of danger, the resident minister in the Mediterranean would fly to the spot. We always called him Res Med because that was his telegraphic address. Well, I mean his name, resident minister in the Mediterranean. He was splendid, just the person to have. Well, then Field Marshal Alexander came in and out, and he was so impressive. He was one of these very still, quiet people. It reminds me of a quotation from Henry V, but I'm not quite sure that I can capture it. Nothing so becomes a man as modest silence and humility. It absolutely catches Alexander. He simply didn't speak really unless he was spoken to. He was just quietly, silently there and doing his stuff, of course. Great contrast with Monty, who came in later. Oh, what a showman! He wore his beret indoors and in the presence of ladies with two badges on. But of course he went on, got on so well with the troops. I mean that was what he had to do. One's own impressions don't matter a jot. And finally, it was Christmas, and we made an effort about Christmas. And as we couldn't get to either the Anglican or the Roman Catholic Church, because they were in range of the communists, an army chaplain came to celebrate the Eucharist in the ambassador's drawing room. And after the consecration, he quoted from a Greek hymn, "Let all mortal flesh keep silence." It's a beautiful hymn. The end of the word silence, crash and clatter from machine gun fire, absolutely on cue. Then the service, actually, it wasn't stopped or barely disturbed, but the duty officer came in and extracted two Roman Catholic cipherers to decipher a most immediate clear the line telegram. Which announced that Churchill was arriving. He stayed on the Ajax outside Paris and came in the most armoured car I've ever seen with parachute escorts. And then, of course, he was closeted with the ambassador most of the time. He gave us a pep talk later, but to begin with, he was with the ambassador. And Alexander, I think, turned up then too. Lady Leeper had taken a little pepper tree branch, which we'd brought her from the school, as it had red berries. She put it in a pot, and Osbert Lancaster, who had come out as press attaché, rather in the middle of this siege, he cut out little crib figures from his notebook, little paper crib figures, and made them stand the way one used to as a child, make figures stand. These were put round a little bit of pepper tree with its berries, and each side, as it was by the ambassador's secretary's room, there were two paratroopers armed to the teeth, just as much as the guerrillas had been with those great bandoliers, each side of our crib. Well, then Eden came as well as Churchill. And for lunch on Christmas Day, all of us except the ambassador and Churchill sat round a big table in the embassy, eating our reduced army rations. And I was put next to Eden, quite to my surprise. And he showed me his cuffs, which were ragged. He said, my wife, you see, is in Paris with the Red Cross, so he had nobody to look after his cuffs. And then he said, this was very, very sad, he said, and I've had to come out here the last 2 days of one of my son's leave from the Air Force. I couldn't possibly ask for an extension. And the boy, of course, was killed. Not necessarily at that time, but, I mean, he lost that son. One didn't know it, of course, at the time. Well, then he took note of our fare, said, I am going to telegraph urgently to the embassy in Cairo to send you some food, and if possible, some seasonal fare. It's very nice and easy to talk to, Eden. Oh, and then in the evening, yes, this is rather fun to remember. Needless to say, Churchill and had lots of PPSs, you know, a kind of retinue, as it were. And there were all these army ADCs. And so all of us, sort of lesser fry, as it were, made two long lines, and we danced Sir Roger de Coverley to keep warm. There was snow on Hymettus then, which is unusual. And we just sort of bounced up and down to keep ourselves warm. I can never hear Sir Roger de Coverley without thinking of that, of course. And most Christmases, I remember the Christmas there.
Did the VIPs join in?
No, the VIP... Well, Churchill, of course, was the most VIP. No, I saw him one day emerging quite close by from the ambassador's office with a huge bowl of brandy, a huge glass of brandy, and his cigar. He then gave us, in the afternoon, he gave us a pep talk. I don't remember what he said, except that the American ambassador was sitting just in front of us. And Churchill can't have known this. He said, we have been calumniated in the United States of America. You know, in that way in which he used to put an accent on words. And we saw a blush rising up the American ambassador's neck. He was, in fact, very pro-British, but the general American feeling was this was not their business. One day I saw a Volkswagen going by with the Stars and Stripes moored to the back bumper and coming right over to the windscreen. You know, showing that they were neutral. And then somebody else had a brassard of the of an American flag from his elbow to his shoulder. But when our chaps discovered a bomb down in the more or less the drains under the Grand Bretagne, the main hotel in Athens in those days, and the Americans used to go to that hotel for drinks, their neutrality did waver a bit. Their press was terrible. But you see, what had happened was what we were had been we and our, I mean their, sorry, I'm getting a bit tired, their and our press had all been talking about the gallant resistance for years, and then suddenly we were calling them the enemy. And Osbert Lancaster looked after our press and saw that they were turned around, but the American press went on about this lamentable state in which they were totally neutral.
So this is all in December 44?
Yes. Yes, on the 17th of December, I looked at Harold Macmillan's diaries. He goes in considerable detail into this part when he was living at the embassy. He says, on the 17th, machine gun fire is pouring down the road with the at the corner by the embassy, and one had to cross that in order to get in. Well, obviously the machine gunner was not pouring down his bullets when we went by. We ran across the side streets because they were in range at one point. It's odd the way that sort of experience seems to bring a kind of glow to some things in life. I remember looking out of the office window and I saw a dewdrop on a blade of grass, and it was somehow sort of transfigured just because it might be one's last dewdrop.
How long did all this go on for?
Well, by the middle of January, there was a truce. It went, as it were, officially on for about 6 weeks, but it was the first 3 weeks that were the intense ones. I mean, after Christmas, we had two brigades came in. And so in the end, we conquered.
What did your Greek friends feel about the big British presence?
Oh, our friends, of course, were mainly Anglophile. And they were just, first of all, extremely worried that, you know, the communists were going to win, because it did look like it the first week or so. And then very relieved. The communists took some people out of their houses or flats in Athens and made them trudge up to Thebes. And there was snow on the ground, and they just took these people out with not suitable shoes or anything. And I think some of them just died by the wayside. I mean, they were taken as hostages.
Did you see anything of that?
No, I heard it or read it.
Yeah. So what happened to you in 45 and 46?
They gave me diplomatic rank. I was a third secretary. And somebody at home sent me out a cutting from a newspaper from which I learned that I was one of the first three women to be given diplomatic rank. The two others had dreadful jobs. One was in charge of women's affairs in America, and the war was still on. That would have been absolutely unacceptable. And the other was in Sweden, which was neutral. Much better to be in Athens. Siege and all.
Any other memories that we should record about your final period in Athens?
Well, after the siege was lifted, we were all given in turn siege leave, and we had a week in Crete, which was interesting. We stayed in Sir Arthur Evans's villa, which belonged to the British School of Archaeology, and went on a trip up the up Mount Ida to take relief to the peasants in those villages that had been terribly destroyed by the Germans. I mean, in one place they'd hardly left a stone standing on another. They spent about 2 days destroying a village systematically. So that was a horrid sight, but I mean, by that time the Germans were all collected together at Hanyar, and they remained so till the end of the war, behind a prison perimeter. And fortunately I met a friend from Bletchley there, the Honourable Mercy Money Coutts, who'd been up at Lady Margaret Hall. So we went with her on this trip, which was very nice. I mean, apart from the dreadful misery that the Germans had inflicted. We were all given siege leave in turn. We had a week in March and went by a large American plane to Heraklion, and naturally to the Villa Ariadne, Sir Arthur Evans's villa, which he gave to the British School in Athens. There we met this friend of mine, the Honourable Mercy Money Coutts, a daughter of Lord Latimer, who sometime later married her Cretan lorry driver, an excellent man called Michali Sidorakis. And she was setting out on a relief mission to the burnt out villages on Mount Ida and asked us if we'd like to come. Well, of course we did. At the embassy they wanted my husband to write a report on the distribution of relief in Crete. Of course it couldn't have been done better. Mercy spoke Greek with a Cretan accent. She had been an archaeologist of the Minoan, the Cretan civilization, and this was absolutely the right person in the right place. So we set off with her, lying on a huge lorry, I think a 3-ton lorry, on masses of blankets that we were going to distribute to the in the villages. And when we got there, the sight of those villages destroyed by the Germans was simply terrible. Absolutely terrible. They'd taken any men who happened to be there just away and shot them. So there were these tragically unhappy women there and some children. But the Greeks are extraordinarily resilient people, and they put on an amazing feast for us afterwards.